It's my pleasure to be here with you and to introduce you to something a little bit more down to earthly things. Even though, right at the end, I'm going to be talking about electrons and how can we do electron holography. Now, so many years ago, from when Dennis Gabor actually devised the first experiments in holography that actually gave him the Nobel Prize in 1971. But if he could have done the experiments that I'm going to show you right at the end, he probably would have won a second Nobel Prize. So I'm going to be talking to you about some state-of-the-art problems on how to use lasers, in applications in biomedicine. I'm gonna probably rush a little bit in some of the my presentations, but we're gonna be looking at things like very big objects, like a butterfly, or objects that are within our hearing system, that is the tympanic membrane. So we're gonna be talking about those things. We are now able to do these things because we have cameras that run up to 5,000 frames per second at the resolution that we want. Because obviously there are cameras that are even faster than this. But I'm going to show you how can we do this and how can we use these things in real life experiments. So basically what I'm going to be starting with is a little bit of an introduction on interferometry, because it seems that nowadays all these experiments that people are doing on quantum things utilize a lot of the interferometric concepts that were used 300 years ago. And then I'm going to proceed over to the results and the bio applications. Okay. So first of all, I'm going to try to give a brief definition so everything is very clear to us. Since we're talking about the wave nature of light and then the particle nature of light, I want to really have the definition of that the interference relates to the interaction between propagating beams, while refraction is scattering, and refraction depend on the interaction between a beam and matter. So let's make those things very clear. And then a little bit of history. These things that we are doing nowadays wouldn't be possible without the help of all these people. And for instance, Thomas Young, that was the very first experiment on how two waves interact and how two waves interfere. And then we go with all these explanations on people that are very relevant to all of us nowadays. Huygens' theorem, the Fresnel description of how beams propagate. And we go to the one of the names that were mentioned in the past lecture, which is Michelson. Michelson actually devised his own experiment in 1881, and is today being used for, as we saw in the past lecture. And optics, as such, was going almost nowhere until the invention of the laser in 1960. This is a breakthrough, because nowadays, from 1960 up to last year's Nobel Prize, about 40% to 45% of Nobel Prizes in physics are in optics, have to do with something to do with the discovering of the laser, or the invention of the laser. So, but and the other big point about it is that in 1948, Dennis Gabor, which was an electronical engineer, actually invented the principles of holography. And the principles of holography is something that everybody uses today. DVDs, CDs, holograms for almost whatever kind of protection data system that you want. So, okay, and again, if we look at the year 1970 onwards, there is a very rapid progression on all the aspects of holography, because we replace the photographic plates with CCD cameras and nowadays with CMOS cameras. Okay, so I'm going to be just showing you some equations, very simple equations. We have the beam character of the wave character of the light beams and how do they interact. And what we're going to be playing with is this equation. This is the intensity equation due to the sum of two waves. One that I'm going to call the reference wave and the other one that is the object wave. One thing that is important for the experiments that we perform is that the frequency, the frequency of both beams are equal. So we need coherence between the beams, okay? And the other thing is that we need a more or less same polarization of the beams that we're going to be using. When we do that and apply all the concepts, and this is why I say I'm going to go a little bit fast, is that one of the things that we're going to be looking at in all the intensity recovery from the data that we have is only this term, the phase term. The phase term in these experiments only represent the difference in path lengths. One beam actually goes through a path length that is completely different from the other one that is going to be interfering with. So the result at the end that we're going to have is what we call a fringe pattern. This fringe pattern is formed by the interference of two light waves, one coming from the object and one coming from the laser itself. So, and the tricky part here is to recover the phase. That is, what is the optical path that one of the beams actually go with difference with the other one. So this is basically what we do. This sounds simple, but as we're going to see later on, that's the experiment that Dennis Gabor actually performed and won him the Nobel Prize. So nowadays, so what we have is that we have to modify this equation, the intensity equation, in order to recover the phase. And we can modify it in several ways. We can introduce temporal heterodyning, introduce control phase shifts, introduce spatial carry fringes. And today, with the most advanced scanning microscopes, we can introduce here the components of the electromagnetic field and also interrogate the objects that we're looking for. And so where are we now? We have the following available measurement methods. The optical ones, there are a bunch of them in order to perform a lot of experiments and a lot of measurements. I'm going to be looking at this, the digital holographic interferometry, which is a highly spatial, low temporal resolution, as compared to, for instance, the laser vibrometer, which has a high temporal but low spatial resolution. And there are obviously other methods like mechanical, acoustical, pneumatics, but the most common one are in electronical and mechanical engineering are in the strain gauges. So this is pretty much what we see when we perform the experiments. Over here we have again the butterflies, and this is a human face with a throat full of fringes. But how can I interpret those fringes? How can I actually extract this data from what I'm looking at? The registration of holograms is a rather simple experiment. I have to have a coherent source of light, which is in this case is a laser. I have to pretty much do the same experiment as Michelson did. It's pretty much the same. I have to divide the beam in two, one that is going to directly shine onto a hologram plate, and the other one that goes and shines an object, and then the scattered light from the object goes and interferes with the reference beam. The requirements are that the path lengths of the reference beam and the object beam have to be matched, and during the recording, the object phase beam have to cannot change more than 0.2 over pi. So we have two waves, the object wave and reference wave. And the only thing that we can actually see in a detector is the intensity. We cannot see the individual wave components. So if you look at it at this term, this one here, apart from a scale factor, reproduces exactly the wave of the object. Okay, and this is what, in this paper of Dennis Gabor in 1971, won him the Nobel Prize. The setups are very easy. Okay, again, this is a live experiment. If I were able to have here a table with a laser, I could perform this experiment here in front of you and show you on a TV monitor real time fringes. But that carries the problem that I cannot extract directly the phase, the phase that I was showing you in the intensity equation. So I have to come up with a more intelligent method of doing it, which is basically doing some phase carrier fringes here, which is, and experimentally, you just have to rotate this beam splitter here in order to introduce carrier frequency fringes. And in that case, you will have two digital holograms, one in the non-deformist state and one in the deformist state, and then you perform a subtraction of those two states, and you get the fringes. And once you get the fringes, you can play with them, and you can interrogate from very, very big objects. I mean really objects as big as that screen on that we're looking at, or even nano-size objects. The limitations of digital holography are several, but most of them are being overcome with time. One of them that I'm going to put out in the conclusion is that we have to have a smaller angular size of objects and a small object or object situated far from the camera. So, and I'm going fast again because I want to go here. Okay, this is something that is quite nice and quite good. Most of the systems that you use nowadays when you want to perform these experiments are sensitive to only one axis of the displacement of the object. And basically, that sensitivity is out of the plane of the object. What happens with a X and Y sensitivity? If you wanna actually find X and Y components of any displacement of the object, and then convert that into stress, strain, or whatever mechanical parameter, you have to have actually three equations, okay? And the only way to do this and to find it out from the experiment is by illuminating the object from three different positions. And this is a rather simple thing to do. If you consider the sensitivity vector, okay? The sensitivity vector is basically calculated by the source position, the observing position, and a point in the object. And it's done through these equations. And if you want to find it in three dimensions, you find it by illuminating the object in three different from three different directions, as is shown in this object here. And then basically what you end up with is a matrix. And this matrix is going to solve us all the problem, and that's what I'm going to use to show you all the results that I'm presenting. These delta phis are given in the experiment. Those are the fringes that I was showing you somewhere here. So this is experimental. This is calculated from the experimental setup. Lambda is the wavelength of the light of the laser shown. So I am now able to describe dx, dy, and dz from any kind of experiment. And this is done with any object, as big as you want or as small as you want. So basically, say for instance, if you have two laser pulses, like here, you are going to have two digital holograms. And this is the Fourier space. What you do is Fourier transform this, and you're going to have the conjugate of the real part, conjugate of the real part, and conjugate terms from each of the pulses. This is the deformed state or the non-deformed state, and this is another state. And basically, you Fourier inverse the you filter one of them, Fourier inverse them, and then calculate the difference by subtraction between any pair. And this is your delta phi, sorry, this is your delta phi 1, this is your delta phi 2, and this is your delta phi 3. Once you have all those data with you, you can immediately put them on the contour shape of the object, because if you don't calculate also by using some preferably optical technique or non-optical, if you don't have any other solution, you can draw now dx, dy, dz over the contour of the surface. So it all started in 1948 with very simple experiments, but they could not get through with all this until 1970, where the holographic plate was replaced by a CCD camera, a Vidicon camera. So these are the very first experiments. So now imagine an object that is actually been insonificated from the back and is actually vibrating in plane. This is at 33 kilohertz. So this is what we were probably the image on the TV screen is much better than the one on the one above. So just imagine that that you're looking to this in a real plane, and now you're doing these experiments in real time, and you can imagine that the object is doing this and is doing that. And this is a macroscopic object. You can do it on any type of objects, like the tympanic membrane. This is a very difficult object to study, because it's a semi-transparent object, is within the ear cavity, so you have to actually deliver the laser beam with a fiber optic, or device a very specific apparatus to do it. We did this experiment, and we did this project with the Harvard School of Medicine, and it's now converted into an apparatus that is called the OEHO system, which is basically this. It looks like a microscope objective that is actually able to look at the tympanic membrane. And the tympanic membrane, being a semi-transparent object, is not easy to study. So you have to establish certain conditions to actually look at it. Okay. And why did we do this? Because usually when you go to the doctor actually, just with the experience and with a good eye, can tell you if your tympanic membrane is sick or is not sick, okay? So we want to give him a tool by which he can actually assess every time whether your tympanic membrane is healthy or is unhealthy. And this is the kind of apparatus that we use and we devised, and it's up and running. And now what happens to your tympanic membrane when you listen to rock? What happens when you listen to classical music? If I just show you and let you have those images in mind, you would say, like, I couldn't see the difference. But if I convert all this into fringes, and then I subtract the information, the phase that I was telling you about, I can actually transform them into phase maps. And I can actually see the real movement of the tympanic membrane very, very clearly, and without a doubt for a physician now. Okay, so he can have all the data from your first visit to the as a patient, and then you come sick, and then he will notice immediately your tympanic membrane is not behaving as when you were not, when you were healthy, okay? So you can actually see these results in this journal, the HERE Research Journal. Those are pretty old now. But that was one of the structures that we were actually interested in with the Harvard School of Medicine and the Worcester Polytechnic Institute in Worcester, Massachusetts. Okay. But that's not all. Okay. Once you have all the data from the deformation, if you don't have the actual shape of the tympanic membrane, you cannot actually draw the components of the deformation. It's actually worthless. If you have the deformation but you don't have the actual shape of the object, your experiment was not worth it. So this is the very, very first picture of a tympanic membrane, the shape of a tympanic membrane obtained with non-contact methods, okay? And this is something that we also did with them. This is a color map of the tympanic membrane. That's the actual shape. If you actually have a look in the anatomy books, the anatomy books say that the tympanic membrane has a cone shape, okay? But it's not a regular cone shape. This is the handle of Malleus, and the conic shape comes a little bit further away from where one of the bones is, okay? And the most important bit about this is that once I was able to calculate the displacement of the object, of this particular object, I am able to calculate the dx, dy, and dz components of the deformation. And then I can do things like calculate the displacement and draw the displacement in vectorial form, in this case, the tangential displacement along the surface. And if we look carefully, and perhaps it's even better to notice it on the screen of the TV, there is a kind of circulation pattern at certain frequency modes of vibration of the tympanic membrane. So that means that the energy is conserving itself within the tympanic membrane, which is good. So we solve the problem of the tympanic membrane because now we're able to actually see how it works. A semi-transparent object, difficult to look at, but we solve the problem. Now, these are also very preliminary results with a phantom. A phantom is a gel-like structure that the physicians and the biologists use in order to perform experiments. So you actually create this phantom, and then you can put inside the phantom several structures. What we did was to create a phantom and to put inhomogeneities inside the phantom. And these inhomogeneities were anything that you could find in your lab. But particularly, we work with an oncology hospital in our hometown, and they were able to extract tumors from human women breasts. And these were the characteristics of the experiment. And the thing is that we were actually able to detect the tumors within the phantom, okay, which is very good because this is leading to another collaboration with another hospital in the US. But what happens is that when you have the gel just sitting by itself on the laboratory without any perturbation, the surface of the gel looks like this, okay? Remember that now I'm able to quantify all this very, very precisely and to actually shape it on top of the surface. And this is the gel. When I'm placing a speaker on the side of the gel and I'm actually provocating a resonant mode on the surface of the gel, this is how the surface of the gel looks like. So it looks like a resonant mode. It has a valley, a trough, and all this. So it's behaving really regularly. It's a resonant mode is being established within the phantom. But what happens when I introduce one of the tumors inside? And this is not a transparent gel. phantom is a non-transparent phantom. So when I introduce a homogeneity inside it, that is, this is a malignant tumor, the homogeneous shape that we saw before gets destroyed, and we can immediately find on the surface of the phantom this characteristic, which is due precisely to the breakage of the resonant mode inside the structure. So, and if we do this from three different illumination directions, left, center, and right, then we can reproduce all the things that we want to say. And for instance, we can trace a line on the center, and we can find exactly, with very high precision, the localization and the depth within the phantom of that homogeneity. So the experiments work. The experiments are they've been proved in many cases, and this is an alternative. Instead of having the women or being tested and being the mammography is not a very nice test for women. We can have them laying on the front and perform this experiment, and it's proven to be one alternative again to test the existence of homogeneities within the breast. Okay, so you know that in Mexico we have a lot of butterflies. I saw a museum, or there is a site very close to here that is a conservatory. Okay, I think that one of the sites in Mexico, very close to Mexico City, where we have millions of butterflies, come from Canada. They migrate from this country to our country. Okay, so we were just wondering what happens if we could actually see them. What's the structure of their wings while they are flying? Okay, so we have a lot of butterflies there. So just in case some of you are saying, oh, you are very cruel. What do you do with the butterflies after you experiment them with them? We just release them. So we experiment with them. We cut the fixings, and then they go. So nothing happens to them, okay? So I have to show you this because otherwise more of you are gonna tell me, but you're killing the butterflies. No, I'm not killing the butterflies. Okay, so what do they do with them? We have several species, so we wanted to compare four different species of butterflies and how do they behave while they're flying. Apparently, if you see them butterflies, and you see them over here, you're gonna say the wings actually behave the same from one to another. But this is not true. The wings actually behave quite differently from one another. This is some of the experimental details that we were using, a green light. We were recording at 4,000 frames per second with a 800 by 800 pixels, and something that is very important for this type of experiment is the dynamic range of the CCD camera. In this case, it was 10 bits. And here we go. These are the results. Oh, sorry. Okay, I had to click. Yeah, good. So these are the four different butterflies, and if you look closely, all of them behave differently. Okay, none of them actually have the same pattern of wing flapping. Okay, and this is very important for people designing airplanes, because I think that one of the solutions is to have active wings. But this is my opinion. Okay, so you can see it more clear here. Okay, this was the front cover of the Optics Express in 2010, in one of the issues of Optics Express. It appeared on the front cover, so you can see it live here. Okay, and I can assure you the butterfly, we released a butterfly and probably it was eaten by some other bird there, but that wasn't my fault. So I'm coming to the end. Now these are very preliminary results. So we take all of our expertise in digital holography from the big objects like the ones you saw to the very exciting field of nanotechnology, nanoscience. And I say this because in 1948, Denis Gabor actually was working on this, but he wasn't able to proceed any further with his experiments because he didn't have the technology that we have today. So he only published a paper that said that this was possible. And with the invention of the laser, people realized that it was possible, and he won the Nobel Prize, okay? But he actually predicted more things to actually do holography with electrons. All the holography that I was showing you is with light, with photons, okay? But can we do it with electrons? And indeed we can, okay? So we devised an experiment in one of these very sophisticated scanning transmission microscopes that are some more millions of US dollars. We actually devised a holographic experiment inside it. So this first result has just been accepted in the journal Micron, and it's to do with what happens if you are now have a nanoparticle and can actually shape exactly the nanoparticle. You can find actually the shape of the nanoparticle and then place it in a bacteria, for instance, and try to locally kill the bacteria. So we don't know that yet, but the stage that we are in is that we're able to actually shape a gold nanoparticle. This is 10 nanometers wide. And this is the actual shape found by holographic electron microscopy. This is the one that got accepted, that it will be published probably next week. And this is a bacteria. This is a bacteria with a nanoparticle here. It's probably better seen on the TV monitor, okay? So it's got a... we see that the nanoparticle at the edge of the bacteria here. Sorry. I should be doing this. Okay. Another question is, what is the shape of the bacteria? Okay. Can anyone actually guess what is the shape of the bacteria? I showed you in the past 30 minutes or so that we can actually find the shape of things using optics. Okay. So with the same apparatus, and this hasn't been published, this is the shape of the bacteria. Okay? I'm sorry? No, I cannot tell. But this is the nanoparticle here. But it's like a peanut. Okay? This is the shape of the bacteria. And this hasn't been published, so this is all I'm gonna tell you about. Okay? So where is my chairman? Okay. Okay. So this is what optical non-destructive techniques can do for you, you know. They can actually help you to find what is happening to an object without touching it. You are interrogating any type of object now, from a very big one to a nano scale one. And you can actually find the shape, you can find the displacement. Once you find the next experiment with nanotubes and nanoparticles is try to deform it in real time within the experiment and try to then assess the X, Y, and Z components. There is a group in France that has already devised one of these experiments to illuminate the particle from three directions. They're a little bit ahead of us, but we'll catch them up very shortly. And I think I'm gonna stop here. we're going to be working in biomedicine, nanoscience, and technology, and a very exciting field for me that is the optomechatronics. The research team, I'm very thankful to them. Most of them are former PhD students of mine. And this is my new group in, I'm part of that group in the University of Texas in San Antonio. Thank you very much for your kind attention.
Thank you for the very enlightening talk. We have time for a few questions.
Thank you.
Thank you for pointing out the immense impact that lasers have had on basic research. I'd like to point out that that's now being extended from, I mean, most of the work you've talked about is using lasers in the visible and near visible wavelength range. We now have lasers operating, free electron lasers, down to one angstrom, and one can expect that the impact on basic research will continue. These extraordinary pulses of fully coherent X-ray light, just starting a few years ago at the SLAC National Accelerator Laboratory and other places around the world now, are producing fully transverse coherent X-ray beams at one angstrom wavelength, 1.5 angstrom, in femtosecond pulses that have instantaneous peak power of 10 gigawatts. And there are immense opportunities that are going to be realized. For example, because the pulse length is so short, people are expecting to be able to make X-ray movies of protein folding, chemical reactions, biological process. Very exciting for all these young students here to think about what they could do with an X-ray laser.
That's quite correct. I mean, the groups in Germany, groups in the States that I know of, they are in the attosecond at the moment. They're on the which is very exciting. It's and it was a breakthrough. Really, it was a breakthrough when the discovery of the laser has actually made all these things happen recently. So it was just less than 60 years ago. This is correct.
One more quick question. Thanks. So I was wondering, with the butterflies flapping, you had this scaling as something along on the order of a micrometer, or like submicrometer, so probably on the order of the wavelength, roughly. And I was wondering, when you think butterfly flapping, I usually think of like a couple centimeters of motion. Yeah. What kind of motion happens at that micrometer scaling?
Now, that was good that you actually asked that question, because I thought that somebody was going to say, well, but these things actually flap within millimeters or even centimeters. Now, we were actually looking at with the 5,000 frames per second, we're actually able to actually see the whole movement and choose from that movement just a tiny section, and then see what is happening there. But it's very repeatable. Once you have that, you have the whole flapping. So you're right in observing that. Yeah.
Thank you. Let's thank both speakers for a very good session.
Thank you.